Blog Talk Radio.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Have I told you lately that I care? Yeah. Have I told you lately that you are wonderful? You're magnificent and so much more. Have I told you lately that I love you? Have I told you lately you're my king? Have I told you lately that you are number one? You're magnificent and so much more.
So I stand in the presence of your glory.
Hello, 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 Radio Land. This is Dr. Maxine Bryant, and welcome to the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. I'm happy to have you, and you on Blog Talk Radio, Tribe Family Channel. Our producer is Beverly Black, and we are excited to have you. Now, in my promotional, you heard me or you saw me promote Tonier Kane Muldrow, who was going to be our guest. She was unable to make us, but at the last minute, you know, God always has a ram in the bush. We have yet another guest. I'm going to introduce you to him in just a moment. But as in the fashion of the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show, I have a poem that I want to begin with. Unlike all the other poems that I usually open the show up with, I did not write this one, but I think it's fitting as I introduce our guest for the 5 o'clock hour. It's actually written by a woman by the name of Portia Nelson, and it's called The Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters. Chapter number 1, I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter number 2, I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes me a long time to get out. Chapter number 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it's there. I fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am, and I have to admit it is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter number 4, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter number 5, I walk down a different street. As I said, Tonier Kane cannot be with us, but we do have Justin Volpe. Several years ago, I was a consultant with Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA. And in that particular role, we went across the country educating criminal justice professionals, mental health professionals, people who worked in addiction, substance abuse, and we talked to them all about the importance of trauma-informed care, particularly as it relates to people who are stricken with addiction or battling addiction and people who find themselves in the criminal justice system. So I have on the line with me today, in the studio with me today, Justin Volpe. Justin, how are you doing?
Great, Maxine. Good to hear from you.
It is good to hear from you. Now, I chose that poem because all too often, loved ones and well-meaning people will ask people who are in the midst of their addictions or who keep getting in trouble with the law and going in and out of jail and in and out of prison. And they say, why can't you just get it right? Why can't you make different choices? Why can't you walk down a different street, so to speak, to use the metaphor used in the poem. But what we realize when it comes to trauma-informed care is that walking down that other street, doing something different, is not the simple answer. Am I right?
Absolutely. It takes a lot to choose a different street, to change, you know, our old patterns and habits. And I'll tell you what, you had five chapters in that poem. It may have taken me a whole book.
Okay. Okay. Obviously. So
yeah, you gotta keep working at it. And I'm happy to say I haven't had a drink in 6 years or a drug in 11. And I'm
awesome.
34 years old now, and I work a job helping other people in recovery. And my path was not easy, and as is anybody else struggling out there. But the one thing you had talked about is making those decisions, but it's really hard to do without support. And so many people don't have enough options, enough places, enough safe places to change these streets that they're on all the time. You know, how about we move them to a different neighborhood? Maybe they'll find different streets there. You know, but who has resources like that when you're struggling, when you're in the criminal justice system, when you're in the same pattern? And sadly, people get stuck in this system their whole lives, and we know this. Yeah.
Wow. Now, I know your story, Justin, but our audience doesn't. So I met you when I was a consultant with SAMHSA, and we were both on the kind of like the traveling circuit together talking about trauma-informed care. Can you give our audience just a brief overview of circumstances in your life that contributed to your addiction and to your involvement in the criminal justice system?
Absolutely. Well, Maxine, as you remember, I was born and raised in New Jersey. My grandfather and uncle had serious mental illness, even my grandmother on my father's side, and had Great Depression. And my grandfather, when he started to get sick, he delved really deep into religion, and he had a delusion that the religion he was involved with told him that he was a prophet from God, and that he started to tell people other in this group that he was, and this is the 40s now, this is a long time ago. My grandfather was born in the early 1900s. He's long past now. And, he wasn't an alcoholic. Drugs weren't a thing back then, and he was well-dressed, and people listened to him. People listened to him, and he developed a religious cult based on this belief, and he believed that God spoke to him and told him that the world was going to end and that he had to get a group of people and get them ready for the apocalypse, you know. And my brother and I grew up in this situation. I was born into it. It was we weren't allowed to talk to anybody outside of the group. It was very traumatic to have some of their first thoughts and things passed on to you from family that the world was going to end and that everybody outside of this small group of maybe, I don't know, 70 people was evil and going to die. You know, everybody else was going to die except us. And it was very traumatic. And, you know, I know there's different forms of trauma that people can suffer. And, they all are impactful, especially on a developing child. And, you know, I was raised like that. My brother got into it with some people in this group. He was older than me. And they told us, you know, you have to go. You can't be here anymore. So they put me into public school, and like a good family, they swept it under the rug and said, you know, you're going to school now, just forget about all this stuff. And I said, well, you know, is the world going to end or not?
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and you know, my grandfather had said it was going to end in 1978, 1985, you know, he's one of these guys that kept pushing it off.
Okay.
And, school was an adjustment. I went from a real strict religious environment to public school, you know, keep people drinking, smoking, and, it went from a controlled environment to not that. And, you know, by the time I got into high school, one of the first friends that I made outside of this cult, who was like my first real contact to reality, was he died in a motorcycle accident at 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and I took it hard, and I started to go the wrong way in school. I started to hang out with a different crowd, and, you know, I the journey into drugs and alcohol began. And it took me to a very low place in New Jersey, got me into trouble with people. They put an undercover cop at our high school to try to bust people. And, you know, I was just searching for the answer, and drugs and alcohol had alleviated that pain that, you know, that just trying to fit in, just that it took the edge off, you know, and I felt better, and but, you know, everything else suffered, and my addiction grew. I graduated high school by the skin of my teeth, and I dropped a lot in classes, and, you know, I had always worked since I was 14 years old to pay for my addiction, to hold a job. I moved to Miami. My brother was here. And, I had never told anybody about this religious cult. I had never told anybody it was something I was going to take to my grave with me, basically. And I moved to Miami from New Jersey. And things just escalated. They got out of hand real quick. I moved to Miami in 2003. Within 4 years, I had had over 24 jobs. I had moved over 10 times, one relationship after another. My life was complete unmanageability. You know, it was a disaster. And around that time, toward the end in 2006, my drug use got very heavy, and they diagnosed me with a serious mental illness. And a lot of my delusions that I was having were based on the teachings that were taught to me as a child about the end of the world. And I thought some of my delusions and paranoia were about the apocalypse and terrorists, and whatever was in the news at that time, you know, was just leaving a image on me and backing up my early teachings that things are messed up and the world was going to end. And they put me in rehab, but rehab, you know, wasn't the answer, because I had a larger problem to take care of, and that was my mental illness. So I got sent to the hospital after you know, trying to get you know, I was getting into trouble with my family because my parents were divorced. I was flying back and forth, telling them people were after them, out to kill them. They breakaractomy me, which is involuntarily hospitalized. I got to the hospital. They gave me medication, and I'm like, you know, how do you feel today? Tell them the same thing. Well, this went on for like 3 weeks, and I think they were going to send me to the state hospital or something. And I said, you know, I finally just lied to them and told them I felt better.
Okay.
So they could send me home. I got discharged with the meds. I started taking them. I felt better. And like somebody that's prescribed antibiotics and maybe has a week supply and stops taking them after 3 days, I stopped taking them because I felt better, and I got sick again.
Wow. So how did you break your cycle? Well, before we go into breaking the cycle, you ended up in jail at some point, didn't you?
Yeah, I ended up incarcerated right after that. After I stopped taking the meds, I got picked up on a felony. And
okay.
I was on the infamous forgotten floor of the Dade County Jail for about 2 months. And it was very, very bad conditions.
So you ended up being re-traumatized again, even while you were incarcerated.
Oh, yeah, people were getting beat around the clock. The corrections officers were just ripping into people. There was screams all the time. I had a hard time telling the difference between reality and delusion, because things were so bad in there. You know, jail is not the place to get help.
Okay, but yet so many people who have mental health issues and addictions-related issues end up in our county jails or even in our prisons in the United States because we're not knowledgeable enough and equipped well enough to address those issues outside of incarceration. And so when you think about, when you look back in your mind and you think about your story, what was your turning point? At what point did you get the help and the support that you needed to begin to do something different?
Well, actually when I got released from jail, I got hooked up with a program that I now work for, and that was a jail diversion program, and it forced me into treatment, made me take my meds, and through some slips and slides in the community, I got back, and you know, I started to feel better. I stopped doing drugs, and I started to feel better. And I closed out my case after 8 months.
Okay.
And they offered me a job, and it was unbelievable to have.
Wow.
I went from having an open felony to becoming a county employee within 9 months.
Oh, wow. Awesome. And so,
but that's what people need. You talk about turning points in recovery, and
yeah.
People need opportunities. We can't expect to go into the same streets that make that same decision and come out on top every time. You know, people need to give back, and working with other people in this program, you know, I've helped close to 1,000 people get out of jail the last 10 years and linked them personally to services in the community. And, you know, people need more than what we're offering them, you know.
Awesome, Justin. So now, with the initiative that you and I were both involved in, the emphasis was on trauma-informed care. And I'm getting ready to go to commercial break in a second here. But when we come back, I want to ask you, I want you to think about and answer, how was your trauma addressed? And I specifically kind of want to visit the physiology of trauma and how it impacts the brain and the ability to really think through and process sound decisions and make sound decisions. So I want you to think about that. We're going to take a break here and listen to a commercial.
Motivational, educational, informative, inspirational, relevant, knowledgeable. Nationally, internationally, these are the words seminar participants have used to describe this dynamic presenter. Topics as non-threatening as customer service. Topics as delicate as race relations, diversity, and inclusion. Dr. Maxine Bryan has repeatedly captured the hearts and minds of many audiences. Dr. Bryan's expertise has assisted private industry and nonprofit businesses as they move forward to realize their desired goals. Call Pat Maltz at 612-876-7964. Book Dr. Bryant. Take your workforce to the next level.
Okay, and listening audience, if you want to get in on the conversation with Justin Bulp and myself, please jot down this number and feel free to call 347-539-5285. Again, 347-539-5285, and the line will be open for you, and you'll be able to join in the conversation. Now, Justin, back to my pre-commercial question. You and I were involved in an initiative that sought to educate professionals about the importance of trauma-informed care. So, and you talked a little bit about at the top of the hour about some of the trauma that you experienced growing up in the strict religious environment and your friend dying at the age of 14 and being incarcerated in the county jail and being exposed to maltreatment and fights and just all of those things that you experienced. At what point was your own trauma, how did your own trauma become addressed? How was your own trauma addressed? That's what I'm wanting to ask.
It was after I had got a job and I sought help and I found a therapist that had a center called the Trauma Resolution Center fun enough. It was great, and they addressed it through going down the issues that I had traumatic events happen, and we went over them until I came to some sort of resolution for them and let it be. And it was a lot about forgiveness and forgiving people that, you know, will not always appreciate it or say thank you or whatever, you know, because, you know, you got to worry about yourself. And that's the thing about trauma work and what we talked about. You know, what we talked about when we did the trainings is like the way you want to approach somebody, anybody, is like they've experienced trauma. You know, generally anybody. Some people handle it better. Some people have different mechanics to deal with it. In my case, I had the mental illness piece in the background, so it may have affected me more, right? But this is very real. When somebody's around an abuser, when somebody's around a situation like that, you know, physical changes start to happen to the body. So you never know if you're going to do this type of work. You could trigger somebody just from saying hello or shaking their hand.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And we ask the wrong questions. We ask, what's wrong with you? We ask, why can't you get it right? We ask, when are you going to learn? Why don't you just stop, right? And
right.
I can even remember asking my daughter that, and I realized after she died that she had experienced traumatic events in her life that impacted her decision to, not only her decision, but her drug use, and subsequently played a role in her death. For those of us who have loved ones who are either addicted or in and out of the criminal justice system, what can we do, Justin, so that we're not aiding in the trauma, so that we're not triggering and re-traumatizing?
Yeah. You said as families to do that or just working in the system?
Yeah, what can families, loved ones do?
Yeah, as loved ones, they probably have it harder than anybody else.
Mm.
You know, we take it personally. We put the blame on our shoulders, and I would say to seek outside help and to definitely get another opinion and to try to do something as in such a good, loving method that you can without judging or criticizing the other person and without enabling them at the same time. That's why it's a tough stance to be that family member. Yeah, because, you know, you want to help them, but you don't want to see them locked up, and sometimes that's the only option there is, and it's so sad. It's so sad. So what I would say is seek outside help. If you don't have money or insurance, there's a lot of free resources and sliding scale places that you can maybe look into in your community, and that, you know, people respect the truth and the family members, and to just come clean with them and put it all on the table. And, you know, you get a lot when you put the truth out there, and you know, you can expect a better result.
One of the things that I learned when we were all working together, if you will recall, we worked in teams of three. We would have a physician, a trauma survivor, and then someone like myself who just kind of not moderated, but was the bridge between the trauma survivor and the physician. And we had a person who worked with us, and I can't remember her last name. Her first name was Sherry. Do you remember Sherry?
Therese,
that's it. I knew it was something. Okay.
Yeah, I worked with her at the Jail Diversion Program here.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, she introduced to me and others who were attending the sessions that we facilitated, the fact that trauma that happens to a person, and like you just said, people respond differently. We don't all respond to trauma the same, but that there is a change in the brain, that the frontal lobes are impacted, and that's where our thoughts are. That's how we process information. And in being involved with trauma-informed care, you know, through the care that's based on evidence-based practices around TIC, trauma-informed care, can begin to help people to actually think differently and to learn the benefits of, to learn how to process differently and learn the benefits of processing differently. What were some things that you had to learn to think about differently?
You know, working in the criminal justice system, I had to learn to think differently about police and, and corrections officers going in and out of the jail. You have to play a different role.
Okay.
And, you know, I actually have the privilege to work training police officers now in Compassion and through my personal recovery story. And you know, I still have bouts of things I have to battle myself. And, you know, having some clean time and making good decisions helps you make better decisions. And I think the biggest thing that has changed in me is just in my thought process is just giving something a minute to settle in before I react to it, before I start thinking a certain way or going to do something. I let it process, and then sometimes I let it simmer a couple of days if it's that big.
Right, and that makes sense. That's probably good for all of us to do, particularly if you have some addiction issues or mental health issues and challenges. So, but your story doesn't end even with your job. You've had some wonderful personal gains. Want to tell us about that? On your personal life, you're married, got children.
Well, I've been with my wife 10 years now. We have a beautiful son. He's going to be 7. You know, I have a home instead of, you know, living in the bad neighborhoods I used to stay in. And, you know, I've had a, you know, career. I've traveled nationally sharing my recovery story and training other programs. And I'll be in New York Friday for something at NYU. And I get a lot of opportunities, and it's a blessing, and it's a place that I never imagined I'd be. And, you know, I just want to know that, you know, let you know there's hope for anybody out there. You know, it may seem like it's dark sometimes, but things can get better if the pieces fall. And for those that have lost ones or have people incarcerated right now, you know, my prayers are with you guys, and I hope you find the help that you need.
Absolutely. And so that's actually, you kind of led into what I wanted to end our conclude our segment on. What advice would you give to people who work in the field of addictions or in the field of criminal justice? What advice would you give those professionals who are working with people who have experiences like yours, you know, whether it's substance abuse and or mental health and or criminal justice? What can people who work in the field do differently or better so that we're not re-harming people?
Well, first, you got to do one thing, and maybe you all could do this for me tonight, is you got to take care of yourself. You know, you got to do something for yourself every day, whether it's a half an hour, something nice to take care of yourself, because self-care comes first, so you don't become jaded, and you have more insight on how you're dealing with people. Because a lot of times people that work these jobs, you know, I'm guilty of it too. I've had bouts of bad times in this job, and you know, it catches up to you, and you think nobody's going to get better, and it's horrible, and the system's so messed up, which it is. But to tackle it, to be our best versions of ourselves, you know, we have to incorporate self-care, no matter which you choose to do that, whether it's through exercise, prayer, going to the beach, going for a run, going outside for an hour sometimes helps, you know.
Okay. And what's the other thing? You said there were two. What's the other thing you would advise people who work in the field?
No, I had said to treat people like they all have some sort of trauma they need to be cautious of how they react to people. I've just met people same day, and they give me a look like, you know, I look like somebody, or, you know, or I said something a certain way. I once told a guy, he started working. He got out of the homeless shelter. He was on his meds. And I told him, he was working, I said, man, I knew you could do it. You always had a lot of potential. And that word potential got him so upset at me.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was there really saying all I could say to encourage him. And, yeah, he took it the wrong way, and we just got to remember, you know, we don't know what somebody's trigger is. We don't know what they've been through. And to back down off that horse, if it comes to that. If you get into a pissing match with somebody, with a client working in this field, you know, it's just like customer service. The customer's always right. You know, you got to do what you got to do to help them and help the situation.
Okay. And for people who are experiencing, they're in the throes of their addictions, they are perhaps incarcerated or in and out of jail, what words of wisdom do you have to share for them or with them?
That I think this, you and I know, Maxine, that, you know, there's a large representation of people in jail for low-level crimes and prison for drug offenses and mental illnesses that shouldn't be there.
Right.
That shouldn't be there. And, you know, it's not right. And people that work the system maybe 20, 30 years, even longer than me, know it's not right. And we just hope that, you know, that people will learn from this one day and never, the United States doesn't have to have the largest population of mass incarceration in the world, and that we actually try to help our citizens, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. Justin, thank you so very much, particularly for coming in on at the last minute. I appreciate you. I have fond memories of the time there was three of us were down in Florida with the SAMHSA. Rotating trainings, and so I appreciate you coming on. Thank you, and we're going to go to commercial break, and when we come back, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking to Michelle Barad somewhere in the middle. Thank you very much, Justin. We'll talk
Thank
to you,
you.
Another
Have a
great
time. Night.
Thanks.
Okay.
You too. Bye-bye.
Have you been frozen in fear, stuck on stupid, lost in love, tormented with troubling relationships, felt disconnected, discombobulated, and dismissed? Has parenting ever felt more like a burden than a blessing? Have you questioned your own sanity, doubted your own self-worth, wished you were someone else somewhere else? Do you ever feel you're not good enough, not pretty enough, not smart enough, not talented enough, unworthy, unlovable, undeserving? Then you know what it feels like to be out of your groove. The Groove Doctor has just the right prescription. Get your copy of Dr. Maxine Bryant's book, I Want My Groove Back God's Way. Begin your journey today living in real groove. Dr. Maxine Bryant uses her own experiences and spiritual insights to guide the reader to a place of real groove, by helping readers attain a holistic state of groove based on Bible principles. Go to www.mygrooveback.com to order your copy today. $10 plus shipping costs. You will be glad you did.
Michelle.
Yes, ma'am.
How are you, dear?
I am very, very, very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm excited to have you on the show, Miss Michelle Barad. Tell us, first of all, about Somewhere in the Middle. What's that all about?
Well, Somewhere in the Middle was started on Tribe Family Channel, and the vision was really to bring people in from different backgrounds, although I tend to focus a lot on writers because I write and I'm in editing and publishing, but to bring in different people from different backgrounds to just talk about their lives, their journeys, because I believe that one of the challenges we have, especially right now while things are so polarized in our country, is that people don't talk to one another, they don't listen to one another, and therefore we don't understand one another. And where there's no understanding, there tends to be fear.
Wow. How true. How very, very true. So you are a mother, an entrepreneur, author. Oh, my goodness, you wear so many hats. How do you know what hat to put on at any given time? How do you know that?
I just wear a big stack of hats all the time. That way I don't have to remember which one I need to put on at any given moment.
I know that's right. So listen, I think the audience, many of people who listen to the show are women, and they're women who are enduring struggles and just everyday stuff that we all go through. And I think you have quite an interesting story. Can you just share with the audience highlights of your journey that you want them to know, that can encourage them and let them know you've been there and you have survived, you've overcome. In essence, you have thrived in spite of setbacks and disappointments and all of that.
Wow. Well, that's a big, that's a tall order. I'll see what I can do. Because, you know, I say that because, you know, we don't think that our own stories are extraordinary, because we are living our story. You know, we're just doing what we do, especially, I think, women in particular. We tend to just kind of do and make things happen, and we don't think anything special is going on. But in some ways, there is a lot special going on, because there are women growing up with challenges and growing into challenges every day. So I have a pretty simple story. My story, I grew up in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And my parents separated when I was eight-ish, if I recall correctly. And I mention that because I think my story could have gone much more the route of your previous guests, in that I think there was a certain amount of trauma and a certain amount of disconnectedness that resulted from some of those things that did put me on a tricky path for a while there. You know, I have my moments.
Okay.
You know, in high school, and, you know, New Orleans was one of those places, at least back then, I can't speak to it now, where we had a great deal of freedom. We could kind of roam about as we pleased, and I did a lot of roaming.
Okay.
And eventually left New Orleans and went to Atlanta, and that's when things started to turn around for me, because I did get out of that environment. I'm a big proponent of what he said about, you know, people going back into the same environment, you tend to fall into the same habits, was what was implied, and I think that's true. And for me, leaving and going to Atlanta shifted the energy such that I was able to develop new habits and new ways of thinking and new patterns. And I graduated from college there, got married, and had my first baby, and then the trouble started in the marriage as things got tricky. And we tried to stay together. We tried very hard. We separated several times and got back together. I eventually had another child. And then in the end, when things broke, they broke badly. They broke aggressively. They broke violently. Mm-hmm. And they broke when I was in a foreign country. So I was actually living overseas. I was living in Mexico at the time. My now ex-husband was an engineer, and he was building the cellular system, working on cellular system in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up actually in hiding for a while, because he and his then girlfriend attacked my children and me, attacked me and tried to take my children from me in front of about 20 plus witnesses in a 5-star hotel.
Oh my. Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's in the police station till 3 a.m. type thing. It was trying to sort out all this in
That's
a foreign
like
language. Yeah. I was thinking I should like do a mini series on this. Right.
Okay.
But, you know, so it was a very traumatic, it was very stressful divorce, and the financial hurdles were terrible, because my ex-husband had way more money than I did, and he did everything in his power to starve me out, and it was a struggle, you know, keeping the lights on. Sometimes the lights would be turned off, and I'd have to scramble to get money and put that money together to get the lights back on before the kids got home from school, things like that. But it was important to me. It was more important to me that I was there for my kids than that I was at, you know, a 9-to-5 steady income type job at that point. Because I felt like it was more important for me to be around as much as possible, that they knew that I was there.
I think that is great. I experienced something similar to you without the violence, but I made a different decision as it relates to the children, and I decided that I needed to bring in the money. I needed to be the breadwinner. And so my decision was different, and I think that that impacted my children. You know, if I could go back, I would find some kind of a balance, a better balance. So I admire the choice you made.
Well, and it was challenging because, you know, if you make that choice, there are a couple of things that happen if you make that choice. One is, first of all, everybody just assumes, oh, you just want to live off of the money that this guy is making, right? That's, you know, your ex-husband. Well, first of all, the way the laws are structured right now, unless you got plenty of money to fight in court, you're not getting anything more than the basic child support anyway, if you even get that. You're lucky if the state helps you get that. So all these folks who talk about, oh, she just doesn't want to work, no, that's not what it is. What it was for me was that I knew that when I was growing up and I was coming home to an empty house, because my mom was working and my dad was not there because he, you know, he was living somewhere else. That gave me a lot of time to make a lot of bad decisions.
Okay.
All because there was no adult around. If there had been an adult in the house, I may not have talked to him about what I was thinking about doing, but 9 times out of 10, I think I would not have made some of the decisions that I made. And that's why it was important for me to be home. Not because I thought my kids were going to come running to me like the Brady Bunch or some foolishness, telling me everything they're trying to do. No, but because they would have said, you know what? Mom's home. I can't do that. It was a very simple reason. It was I just wanted to give my children a little bit more protection from themselves than I had. So, you know, needless to say, you know, we struggled through it. And children are strong, children are resilient, but, you know, in the end, you're the parent. You have to make some decisions, and you have to figure out how to make it work. And that's what I did. I figured out how to make it work. I had different businesses that I started. Some of them were more successful than others. I had different jobs at different times. One job was so stressful, I swear it almost gave me a heart attack, and I'm like, nope, my kids need me, I have to get out of here. So if we're going to, you know, you just have to make those decisions and do what you think is best for you and for your family and for your well-being. And for women, I think it's really important for us to take care of ourselves first, because I don't think that we realize sometimes how much the other people around us rely on us.
Okay.
And so if we don't take care of ourselves, we're not going to be there for them anyway. So that's kind of the approach that I've tried to take.
Okay. So you mentioned that you're a writer. At what point did you realize that that was one of your skills?
Oh, I started writing in elementary school.
Okay.
Yeah, I started writing I'm going to say I was probably about 10 when I started writing.
Writing kind of cathartic for you?
Actually, I used to use it more as a cathartic type thing, but now most of my writing focuses, of course, on business things. You know, so I'm writing for my clients. I'm writing a lot of marketing and things of that nature. I still do a lot of poetry. That's something that I like to do. So, like, shout out to all the poets out there. If anybody's listening, remember it's, you know, time for the Poem a Day Challenge, National Poetry Month. So this is a great time to be a poet because you can, you know, share all your poetry with people right now. But I do still do a lot of poetry. It's something that's an easy thing to do poorly, but you can enjoy it. I don't consider myself to be the best poet, but I enjoy writing poetry. And I also like writing essays, so I do a lot of essay writing as well.
Okay. Now, you have a couple of books out, right?
Yeah. Actually, Love and Other Monsters is out under my pen name with two other poets, and this is actually a love project. It was a project that I did with my two daughters.
Yes.
So Love and Other Monsters is a book of poetry, kind of looking at love from the perspectives of women at different stages of life.
Okay.
A teenager, a young adult, and a middle-aged woman.
Okay. Interesting.
I also am in 20 Beautiful Women, Volume 3, which is a book of essays. And in that book, I have an essay called On Becoming My Own Father. Yes, ma'am. And that is about when I realized that I could not anymore rely on the illusion of having a father to take care of or help or protect me.
Wow. Okay. And so tell us about that. So you realized that, and then what?
Well, I think that one of our challenges, okay, so let me back up, and I'm going to tell you what I tell my children all the time. I tell them that my job is to get them to a point where they can take care of themselves so that eventually they can take care of others.
Okay.
That is what I consider my job to be. My job is not to hold my children so tightly that they cannot blossom into everything they're supposed to be, but to hold them tightly enough that they know that they're secure and they have someone to help them and guide them when they need that. So I think that I didn't realize for myself that I was still stuck a little bit emotionally because of when my parents separated, because of how young I was, and because I wasn't prepared for it in any way, shape, or form. It's not like I saw that they had it's not like I understood. I could look back now and say, yeah, they had a pretty bad marriage. But I think at the time I didn't really understand that they had a bad marriage. So when my dad left, it was such a shock. All I remember to this day is my sister and me crying. Mm. And then he was just gone. You know what I mean?
Wow. Okay.
And I think that emotionally I was still stuck in that stage of really wanting or needing a certain amount of overt love and protection from him. And I just wasn't going to get it. And this essay was about my realization that I wasn't going to get it. And if I wasn't going to get it from him, where am I going to get it? And I can't rely on other people to love me at that level.
Wow, okay.
I can't rely on other people to take care of me at that level.
Yeah.
I have to love and take care of myself at the level that I want to be loved and taken care of. And that's what that essay is about. And I think that's something that we all have to go through on a certain level to truly become adults. Because you know, our parents aren't going to be here forever. And even if you have the most supportive parents in the world and the most loving parents in the world who can and will do anything to help you, at some point they're going to be gone. So at some point we all go through some version of what I would call my realization.
Okay. So this particular segment, I forgot to say it at the top of the segment, is called Groove Talk. And for Groove Talk, it's based upon a book that I wrote, I Want My Groove Back God's Way. And I define groove as being in a place of reckoning, a place of solidness, a place of, when I say solidness, on solid ground. A place where you're rooted and you're grounded and you know who you are. You're in a place of comfort where you you're comfortable with the skin that you're in. Now, sometimes life happens, and it moves us from that place. And when that happens, for many people, it's very difficult to get back there, whether that's the death of a loved one or a broken marriage that you really had no plans on, and perhaps even not even a hint that things were gone awry. Loss of a job, definitely finances, illness, all of those type of things and challenges can knock you off your square. And oftentimes when that happens, we lose track of our groove. And when you look at it the way that I discuss groove in the book. So you mm-hmm. definitely have had what I call some groove-stealing moments, you know, both as a child and as an adult. What suggestions do you have to people who are listening? How do you get through those groove-stealing moments?
Well, for me, it's been more of a spiritual journey.
Okay.
In that, I grew up Catholic. I don't go to Catholic Church anymore. I haven't for many years, although I will occasionally poke my head in just because I love the ritual. I think it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just want what is familiar, you know, and what you learn first, you learn best, as a friend of mine says. Okay. But I tend to look for spirit wherever I am, and I believe that spirit speaks to us wherever we are.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, spirit meets us where we are. So for me, I started doing more meditation. I work with the African spiritual traditions because I have an understanding of spirituality as originating on the continent.
Okay.
And
right. Because
of that understanding, I don't really see as much of a need to go through the European concepts of religion and religiosity in the same way that I did when I was younger.
Okay.
So I tend to focus more on African traditions or the African diaspora. And I think that's a good route for me, and I think it's a good route for a lot of people. I think a lot of people could explore that and really get a better understanding of the Christianity that they practice and so forth, because really they all come from that African root.
Absolutely. One of the most eye-opening experiences I had was when I went to Egypt, and I learned, and I got a chance to comprehend not only just Egyptology, but the basis for what we consider or what we have been taught to be Christianity now, particularly in the Old Testament. And that opened up my eyes so very wide. And so now I have a deeper appreciation for I'm going to say it like my publisher said it. There are many African-centric people who feel he's too Christian, and his Christian friends say that he's too African-centric. And I think somewhere in the middle, to coin your phrase, there's that platform that can be definitely beneficial, particularly when we look at how much of Christianity has been informed by African tradition, and we don't know that, and we've been taught to reject that.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the challenges to me, and I think that's part of the reason that African-American people in particular deal with certain kinds of issues.
Mm.
So I'll give you a case in point. So I used to travel back and forth to Haiti with some regularity. My godmother was from there, and we would go back and forth. And one of the things that I noticed in Haiti is that there was no apology for being black.
Okay.
Whereas, I mean, people were just, they were proud of who they were. They were Haitian, they were black, they were proud. And,
yeah.
And as opposed to here in the United States, I feel like there's a tendency to feel ashamed on a certain level of being African people here.
Mm.
And, with good reason. Obviously, it's been beaten into us that we had no history, we had no language, we had no culture, we had no religion, and white folks had to teach us everything. We were savages and we were stupid. So when that's been drilled into your DNA, because I do believe those things, teaching people those things, and particularly when you do it through violence and aggression, does change the DNA. There's evidence that those things change the brain. So we can presume now that this is part of the DNA of the African American, that we've got this inferiority complex built into us to a certain level. And I think it helps us a lot to go back and look at what our people did. And I don't want to look at the Egyptians, not that I don't like the Egyptians, but everybody goes to Egypt, and Egypt still has all the great buildings, you know, the pyramids and whatnot. That's fabulous. But they have pyramids in South America. They have pyramids in Central America.
Absolutely.
So that doesn't impress me in the same way as people who have managed to hold on to their culture in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
People who manage to hold on to or reconstruct their traditions here on this side of the water.
Oh, yeah.
Because truthfully, we are among the strongest people on earth because we were able to survive and even thrive in spite of all that was thrown at us. And so I think that's really why I look at that differently.
I love it. I love it. Absolutely. I love it. So in your journey, as you have become the Michelle Barad that you are, what are some lessons that you have learned along the way?
I have learned that I have to quiet my mind.
Okay.
Regularly. Mm-hmm. So I start my day in a fairly prescribed way.
Okay.
With meditations and things of that nature to kind of get my head right before I go into the world.
Right.
And I find that for me that works extremely well to help me to make better decisions and to really be able to understand what's going on around me better. I have learned that communication is really important in a relationship because part of the downfall in my first marriage was that we would get angry and one of us would head out the door as opposed to trying to sit down and figure out how to communicate our feelings effectively. And that's hard to do, particularly in this society, which does not, in my opinion, respect feelings particularly well. It sounds contrary to what's going on with everybody feeling like they're being put upon by other people's feelings and having to be so sensitive to other people's feelings. But that's like the big societal thing. You know, in society, we're supposed to be polite to one another and not call each other names and not hurt each other's feelings. I'm talking about in the more intimate sense of your personal relationships. You know, I don't think that we really are taught how to communicate what we need and how we feel.
You're right.
In those settings. So that's something that I've been working on for years. Haven't mastered it yet. Still a work in progress.
Yeah,
a work in progress. Mm-hmm. I've also learned that, you know, sometimes you got to love people from a distance.
Right.
Doesn't mean you don't love them. Doesn't mean you don't, you know, I don't value them. But, you know, I have reached a point in my life where if I have to, I cut somebody off. Okay, well, listen, it's not working out. No hard feelings.
Absolutely.
I still love you, but I'm not going to put myself in a bad situation.
Absolutely. And that's not only just for romantic relationships, but even for girlfriend relationships, sister friend relationships, or, you know, whatever. That's good advice there. But, Michelle, it has been great having you on. We are nearing the end of our time. I wanted to close, since you are a poet, just a piece of a poem that I wrote to honor poets as we close out this edition of the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. It's called Honor to Poets. I write to honor the spoken word poets, the ones who put rhythm to words and melody to syllables and knows it, the ones who make words sing and dance and make us laugh and cry, the ones who have love affairs with words that tell us to live and not die. I write to honor all artists, the ones who give relief with every word, every beat, and every stroke, the ones who put rhythm on canvas and color words with hope. Signing off, Dr. Maxine L. Bryant. Check us out in 2 more weeks, same place, same time. Thank you, Michelle Barad. Thank you, Justin Volpe. Thank you, listening audience, for listening to the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Have I told you lately that I care? Yeah. Have I told you lately that you are one? You're magnificent.